protected.
Makes sense, Fred said, except for the part about knowing there were prowlers at Sayoba. The innies never got a message off, and it's pretty clear they weren't expecting us to show up. It doesn't matter, John said. Maybe the aliens just spotted a prowler visually and wanted to find out why they couldn't see it on their sensors. Or maybe they had a reconnaissance boat watching the rendezvous point before we arrived. What does matter is that they knew what they were seeing, and they were willing to take big risks to capture one.
Damn.
Kelly's gaze went back to the smudges of light on the monitor. They're guarding against boarding actions, and they're trying to capture prowlers. They know the plan. Either that or... Fred hesitated, then sighed and said, Okay, they know the plan. How?
Maybe they figured it out after Netherop, Linda suggested.
If the captain managed to report that he was being boarded, they might have guessed we would try it on a larger scale.
Possible, John said, but that's a big leap, especially on their own.
You think someone helped them figure it out? Kelly asked.
That's a simpler explanation, John said. But simplest is that someone told them.
General Garvin had to have some pretty decent intelligence to lure the Covenant to a rendezvous, and he must have been able to promise them even more if he thought he could strike a deal with them.
Only one problem with that theory, Fred said. Garvin is an innie. How would he get that kind of high-level intelligence?
I don't know, John said. On the monitor, the two sides were already exchanging fire, the aliens hurling salvos of plasma bolts and the humans countering with missile barrages. And still the Covenant capital ships were holding their fighters close, cocooning themselves inside a picket web so tightly woven that a firefly couldn't slip past. But I'm going to find out.
They continued to watch the monitor as the two fleets tore into each other, and the first evacuation ships began to rise out of Biko's pink clouds and head for orbital transfer stations.
The Covenant made no attempt to interfere, perhaps because the number of refugees likely to escape was such a small percentage of the planet's population. Even the largest passenger liners carried no more than 30,000 people, and Biko's total population ran into the tens of millions.
John heard a pair of boots thumping across the deck toward them, then turned to see Avery Johnson approaching in blue light-duty utilities. Other than a brow still lowered in post-concussion pain, he looked healthy and alert enough, and his gait was steady.
"Sergeant Johnson," John said, "aren't you supposed to be resting?"
"Depends on who you ask," Johnson said, "and I was getting bored."
"Join the club," Fred said. "How are you feeling?"
"Like I have the worst hangover in history and can't remember how I got it."
Johnson slipped between Fred and John, then looked around and scowled at the four of them.
"So were you all just going to spend your day lounging around this hangar belly aching?"
"Just watching the battle from a safe distance," John said, "and it's starting to look like that's all we're going to do on this mission."
Johnson leaned close.
"And what if it wasn't?"
John and Fred exchanged frowns. Then John asked, "Are you talking outside the chain of command?"
"Not exactly," Johnson said. "It's authorized. Just quietly."
"I don't like it," Kelly said. "Crowther let us slide on going after the Starry Knight without authorization."
"He did more than let it slide." Johnson leaned behind John to address Kelly. "He knows you saved our butts with your initiative."
"Whatever," Kelly said. "If he finds out we're going behind his back to do something for Nyato..."
"It isn't Nyato," Johnson said. "Crowther wants you to volunteer."
"For what?" John asked.
"Does it matter?"
John glanced up at the bulkhead monitor. The two fleets were close enough now that they had entered evasive maneuvers, filling the darkness with little commas of light as they swerved and bobbed and tried to make themselves unpredictable targets. The Covenant vessels still looked like blue smudges, though they had begun to grow larger and more diffuse as their shells of escort fighters struggled to stay in formation around their motherships. Clearly, even in the middle of a fleet action, the alien commanders were still concerned about being boarded. John turned to the sergeant.
"Yeah," he said, "it might."
Johnson looked confused.
"I thought Spartans always volunteered."
"Nasty rumor," Fred said. "Who knows how those things get started?" Johnson ignored him and looked at the monitor. Okay, what am I missing? Before answering, John turned his palm up, a signal that the Spartans used to ask each other for permission. Aside from Dr. Halsey, Avery Johnson was probably the one person aboard whom the Spartans could trust. But John's next decision would affect the entire squad, and the one training weakness that this mission had exposed in him was his lack of political savvy. John knew someone was playing games with the Spartans. He just didn't know who or why. When he received nods from the other three members of Blue Team, John caught Johnson's eye and looked back to the monitor. "Look at the Covenant fleet," he said. "You see how hazy their ships are?" "Sure," Johnson said. "Their fighters are hanging too close for us to attempt any boarding actions. That's why Crowther sent me down here." "What's he want?" Kelly asked. "To send us to Etalon," Johnson said, "to hit their logistics convoy." For a moment, everyone was silent. Finally, Fred said, "Sarge, maybe you should listen to your doctor." Johnson scowled. "What is it with you people?" "You're talking crazy," Linda said. "The only place the Colonel wants to send us is back to Reach." Johnson's eyes lit with understanding. "You're worried about the argument at the service?" "Among other things," John said. "That was just a cover," Johnson said. "Crowther wanted to hold you back for this mission." "So he threatened to relieve Nieto of command?" Kelly asked. "Wouldn't it have been simpler to explain what he was thinking?" "Not really." Johnson's gaze dropped. "There are other issues." "We have a few of our own," John said. "The Spartans aren't volunteering for anything until you level with us." Johnson thought for a moment, then shrugged. "I guess you deserve to know," he said. "Colonel Crowther didn't like how long it took Nieto to respond to your support call on Sayoba." "Neither did we," John said, "but he took out two corvettes. The Colonel thinks he could have downed the rest by moving quicker." Johnson paused, then added, "And there's something else that he just learned. The prisoner transport never made it to Biko." "Not surprising at all," Kelly said. "The Covenant was firing on everything that left Sayoba, and Bantas aren't exactly stealth craft." "It wasn't hit. Not even a little bit," Johnson said. "The Black Widow has her on a combat camera moving to break orbit." John began to have a queasy feeling in his stomach. "And the pilots were from Nieto's ghost flight." "You see the problem here," Johnson said. "It doesn't mean they were any spies, or that Nieto knew about it if they were. But we need to be careful."
"You think?"
Fred shook his head in frustration and turned to John.
"Now it all makes sense. Maybe Colonel Crowther is right. Nieto really took his time supporting us on Sayoba.
He was using us as bait." As exasperated as John had been with the slow response during the search for the Starry Knight, Nieto had been nothing but supportive of the Spartans before and since, and it was hard to believe the commander might really be an insurrectionist spy. And it worked. He destroyed almost half of the alien flotilla and sent the other two vessels running.
"John, he's been trying to get us killed since the capture attempt at Netherup," Kelly said. "That sensor operator's open comm was no accident."
John dropped his chin and said nothing. "He was no JAG investigator, but the evidence against Nieto seemed pretty flimsy. There were a lot of coincidences that could be explained in a dozen different ways, and it certainly seemed possible that everything being attributed to the commander had actually been done by the missing flight crew on their own. Even the way Nieto had been forced to reveal the Spartans' true age could be attributed to simple curiosity and poor social skills.
So there was the possibility that Nieto was not the traitor that circumstances suggested.
But were the lives of John's entire squad worth that bet? After a moment, Johnson asked, "You want it to be Crowther, don't you?"
"That would be a lot easier, yes," John said. "And who's to say sending us to Edelon isn't a setup as well?"
"Hadn't thought of that," Johnson admitted. "Get the Spartans out there alone and eliminate the 21st's competition."
"That's possible, I guess."
Kelly snorted. Fred shook his head. and Linda rolled her eyes. A small smile came to Johnson's face at Blue Team's collective reaction. Then he continued, "But there's only one way to find out. You have to take the mission."
"Yeah, I guess so," John said. "That's what Spartans are for, right?"
Chapter 18. Ninth Age of Reclamation, 34th Cycle, 64 Units, Covenant Battle Calendar. Bloodstar Flotilla, Captured Banta-class Transport Ameline, Libration Point 4, Third Moon, Planet Borodan, Kyrill System.
"Perhaps tell Zatulai would kill the entire ship's complement later, after his passions had cooled and he could be certain their deaths came at the will of the prophets and not his own. Until then, until his jaws stopped grinding and the knot between his hearts loosened, he would stay his hand and learn what had brought the humans to him, why they had risked their vessel and their lives to trail after the Sacred Whisper in a transport as clumsy, poorly armed, and strangely designated as the Ameline. Zatulai's two young Jerohanai escorts were also on edge, shifting back and forth in their new Bloodstar armor as the pressure in the transport's spacious airlock slowly equalized. The pair were the most assured and cunning of the special pack that Zatulai had assembled to help destroy the hated Spartans, and both were emerging as strong leaders. To prevent them from becoming rivals, a development that would quickly lead to a deathmatch in the brutish Jerohanai culture, he was taking every opportunity to give them tasks that forced them to look upon each other as brothers in arms. Today, he had told them to leave their weapons aboard the Sacred Whisper and accompany him aboard the human vessel, an order that seemed to unsettle both escorts even more than it puzzled them. Finally, Orsun, always the more circumspect of the two, could bear the mystery no longer. "This is madness, Blade Master." His voice was booming and certain, even through the transceiver in Zatulai's helmet. "A ship this size can hold 500 humans. Even Castor and I cannot defend you from so many without weapons." "You, Jerohanai," Zatulai sissed into his transceiver, "always being humorous."
Orsun was silent for a moment, then said,
"I was not being humorous, Blade Master."
Zatulai turned around and looked up at the Jerohanai's unhelmeted head. With its leathery muzzle and long tusks, it was a ferocious-looking visage, one that could still draw a modicum of fear even from him, who had been assigned to kill 27 of the brutes over the years.
"Are you not?"
Zatulai tried to sound astonished.
"So then, you are trying to insult me?"
"Never," Orsun said. "I am only wondering how to defend you without weapons."
"I am a first blade of the Silent Shadow," Zatulai said. "I need no defending."
"Ah," Orsun sounded more confused than ever. "As you wish, then." They stood in silence for a moment. Then Castor asked, "Blade Master, if we are not here to defend you, then why did you command our presence?"
"To make a point," Zatulai said.
"How would it look if I were to board a human ship alone?"
"No stranger than boarding one without weapons," Castor said, "but I am honored to accompany you."
"As long as it doesn't get you killed," Zatulai asked.
"That matters not."
Castor's tone was earnest. "I have set my boots on the sacred path, and I will walk where it leads."
"As will I," Orsun said, "but I would be much the happier if the sacred path does not lead to our deaths."
Zatulai sissed again, this time in genuine amusement. "Not today." A clunk sounded inside the inner hatch, and he turned to face forward again.
"Once we board, stand to your full height, and do not accommodate for their fears. They are not allies."
"You wish us to appear intimidating?" Orsun asked.
"Imposing," Zatulai said. "Disdainful and unconcerned. Do not speak to the humans. You may kill one or two, if necessary, but say absolutely nothing to them."
"As you command, Blade Master." Castor sounded bewildered but obedient. It will be done. The hatch retracted, revealing a pale blue passageway containing 12 wide-eyed humans holding projectile guns with long barrels. Their attire was at best non-military, consisting of threadbare pants and shirts with torn-off sleeves. But Xatalai had studied human culture deeply enough to realize that such a sartorial choice was a type of uniform in its own right, a statement proclaiming the wearer to be fiercely independent and unconcerned with the opinions of others. From previous encounters with such types, he knew it meant they would likely be courageous, but undisciplined, poorly trained, and more likely to initiate a battle out of fear or misunderstanding. Their apparent leader, a square-bodied man with hair to his shoulders and all over his face, spoke in the human language known as English. "Welcome aboard." He used his rifle barrel to wave Xatalai and his companions out of the airlock. "General Garvin is waiting for you in the forward briefing compartment." Xatalai remained in the airlock, his helmet tipped forward to make it clear he was looking at the man's weapon. The leader followed Xatalai's gaze and swallowed hard, then flicked something on the body of the gun, lowered it, and turned to his companions. "Weapons down." Only half of the man's team obeyed instantly, confirming a lack of discipline that would make this visit more hazardous than Xatalai had expected. He had originally debated insisting that the humans come to him aboard the Sacred Whisper, then decided against it. The demand might be interpreted as anxiety, but more importantly, he did not dare to sully the ground of the Covenant's vessels with the footprints of vermin. That had happened enough as of late. When Xatalai continued to wait inside the airlock, the leader glared at the holdouts and growled, "Now, people!" The rest of the man's team lowered their weapons and stepped back. The leader used his free hand to gesture toward the front of the vessel, and Xatalai led Castor and Orsoon out of the airlock. The passageway was large by human standards, but tiny by those of the Jirahanae. The warriors had to walk single file behind Xatalai, each filling the space so completely that his armored shoulders scraped both bulkheads, and his head kept thumping against the overhead. At the first two junctions, a handful of slack-jawed humans stood watching as the trio passed, murmuring among themselves and shrinking back from the huge Jirahanae. Xatalai paid these spectators no attention until the third junction, when one raised a device he recognized as a data pad and began to record his approach. He could not tolerate such an affront, of course. He was not some harmless oddity being paraded down the passageway for these lowly traitors' entertainment. Rather than snatching the item out of the man's hand, which his fellow humans might regard as merely rude, Xatalai waited until he was passing the data pad, then pointed at it. He had barely lowered his hand before Orsoon's fist lashed out to shatter the data pad and send its holder, limp and bloodied, flying into the two humans standing behind him. A startled outcry arose from the man's companions. The one leading Xatalai forward abruptly stopped and turned, his weapon automatically rising. Xatalai grabbed the barrel and held it down, then wagged his head back and forth, successfully mimicking a human gesture of warning. Clearly frightened, the man then lowered his weapon again and spoke into a device on his wrist. After that, there were no more gatherings at the junctions, and the procession soon entered a large compartment containing several rows of cushioned chairs, all facing a blank display screen at the far end of the room. 11 humans were gathered in a large foyer area at the back of the compartment, where a large table had been overturned and an urn of brown liquid spilled on the floor. The humans were watching each other far more carefully than they were Xatalai and his Jirahanae escorts. Several held smaller projectile weapons, not quite pointing them at a heavy-set man with a large amount of reddish hair on his face, who was standing alone in the aisle between the cushioned chairs. The man's brow was dripping with perspiration. A curious physiological trait, Xatalai thought, and his eyes were bulging, and in his arms he held an oblong device about the size of a Jirahanae's head. At one end of the device, a green panel shined bright. That was the trouble with traitors. They lacked discipline. Zatulai moved deeper into the compartment, forcing the humans to fall back so that Castor and Orsoon would have space, then turned toward a slender man with intelligent eyes and a firm jaw, whom he recognized from the renegade's holographic message as General Garvin.
"Oh, no, you don't."
It was the heavyset man with the oblong device who said this.
"You talk to me. I'm the one with the nuke."
Zatulai glanced toward him only briefly, then turned back to Garvin. "Sorry about that." Garvin gestured toward the device in the man's hands. "It's a Havoc Mark 2521 medium fusion destructive device thermonuclear warhead, liberated from Task Force Yama. We thought you might like to know how the Spartans intend to destroy your fleet, so we brought it along. Unfortunately, the moment you boarded, Commandant Booth here snatched it up. He claims it's armed. I was a munitions maintenance chief aboard the Roman Blue, so you had better believe it's armed." Booth directed his next words toward Zatulai. "Either you call off the attack on Biko, or I let it detonate." Zatulai turned his helmet toward this Commandant Booth again and said nothing. Could the man actually believe that a minor Sangheili flotilla commander had the authority to call off a planetary assault? Surely the humans would never entrust their weapons of mass destruction to such a fool. Booth's threat had to be a ruse, some negotiating trick through which the humans hoped to manipulate him. When Zatulai did not reply, Booth grew impatient.
"We had a deal. You were going to spare Biko."
"Shut up, Erland," said a small woman with olive skin. She was holding a sidearm with a barrel as long as her forearm. The muzzle pointed at Booth's foot. Her knuckles were white from squeezing the grip, and her finger was on the trigger. There was never a deal. Only our offer. Booth scowled in her direction.
"Well, there's a deal now, Petora."
He looked back to Zatulai. "Call off the attack, or we all die together." Zatulai realized that Booth was actually a deranged fool. That much was clear from how the woman looked warily at him, and from his apparent belief that a Sangheili warrior could be intimidated by the mere threat of death. In Zatulai's experience, most beings believed of others what they knew to be true of themselves. So would a man who feared death be willing to forfeit his own life? Perhaps, if he valued his world more than his own safety, and was insane enough to believe he could save it with one bomb. But would he do so instantly? Zatulai thought not. He would create a delay, give himself an escape in case something unexpected happened, or in case he changed his mind. Zatulai started toward Booth.
"Stay back," Booth said. "I'm not giving this up until the attack stops."
Zatulai extended a hand, palm up, and continued forward. Booth's gaze dropped to the extended hand.
"What? What's this about?"
Zatulai lashed out with his other arm, sweeping the havoc from Booth's grasp into his own upturned palm. When a countdown appeared on the green panel and his existence did not end in a single instant of searing brightness, he knew he had been right about Booth's character. He brought the warhead up and then used it to crater the man's skull, leaving the body to crumple to the deck. Zatulai turned toward the door and found the olive-skinned woman, Petora, standing in front of him.
"Allow me."
Petora holstered her sidearm and took the warhead from his hands, then examined the green panel.
50 seconds. Anyone know how to disarm this thing?"
General Garvin immediately came to her side and began to study the panel. Zatulai's grasp of human chirography was not strong enough to identify the numbers as they flickered past, but he counted 20 breaths before Garvin began to peck at the touchpad. General Garvin was obviously a disciplined and well-trained warrior, perhaps even one who had taken the death vow and considered his life already sacrificed to the cause he served.
and Zatalai would have to treat him with more caution than the rest of these traitors. If they all survived the next few seconds, of course. Garvin finally stopped pecking, and the countdown ceased before the green panel went dark. The general cleared his throat. Was that a sign of human anxiety? Then took the warhead from Petora and held it out to Zatalai. Please accept this as a token of our goodwill. Zatalai studied the weapon for a moment, pondering the possibility that the gift was simply a trap designed to sneak powerful munitions, or possibly a spy device aboard a Covenant ship. But aside from Garvin himself, the personnel aboard the human ship did not seem disciplined enough to execute such a deception. And even if he was mistaken, it seemed an overly elaborate ruse to destroy a single Covenant vessel. Zatalai motioned Orsoon to come forward and accept the warhead. To be on the safe side, he would suggest having the device studied in isolation on a smaller ship. But the potential intelligence value was too great to forego. If the engineers could learn how to prevent the devices from detonating, then the threat to the Covenant fleets would be greatly reduced. Once Orsoon had taken the warhead, Garvin said what happened on Sayoba wasn't our doing. The Spartan task force showed up the day before our meeting with you and took us by surprise. He looked at the floor, then added, "We think it was just an unfortunate coincidence. They were intending to stage their operation out of the same ice quarry that we chose for the rendezvous." Knowing that his black, elongated faceplate would make him appear all the more enigmatic and menacing, Zatalai kept his helmet tipped toward Garvin and remained silent. The only thing about the coincidence at Sayoba that did not seem plausible was that Garvin had not foreseen it. There were three moons orbiting the planet the humans called Biko, but two were being actively mined for heavy metals. Only Sayoba was deserted, and its abandoned ice quarry was an ideal staging area for an attack on the world itself. And that thought made Zatalai remember Garvin's first message. "We have a little project we'd like your help with." Now Zatalai understood why there had been so many traitors on the moon. Garvin hoped to overthrow this planet's rulers and take their place. And he wanted the Covenant's help. After a few more awkward moments, Garvin said, "We have another gift." He slowly began to reach toward his shirt pocket. Zatalai knew the general feared the movement would be interpreted as a hostile act, but there was no need. Now that he understood what the traitors wanted, he no longer was concerned about their intentions. When Garvin removed his fingers from the pocket, they were holding a small flat object about the size of his palm, what the humans called a data card. "We've been trying to procure a suit of the Mjolnir power armor that the Spartans wear. Unfortunately, we haven't been successful. Not yet." He held the card out to Zatalai. "But this data crystal contains schematics for their armor. If you haven't captured a data pad, we can supply one." Zatalai had captured many data pads during his infiltration assignments and knew how to use them all. He motioned Castor to come forward and accept the data crystal, then tipped his helmet forward and continued to study Garvin. By now, Garvin had realized that Zatalai was not going to speak to him. "We have nothing more to offer at this time," Garvin said, "but our spies are well placed in Task Force Yama, and they've been able to plant a number of listening devices in key locations. If you can help us take control of Biko, we can help you anticipate the Spartans' next moves." Zatalai would be happy to accept the offer, on his terms, at least. He had listened in dismay as his blood stars fell to the Spartans in the Battle of the Ice Quarry, and his efforts to capture one of their prowlers had brought only disaster and the mockery of the fleet of inexorable obedience's San Shayum magistrate, the minor minister of artifact survey. Zatalai cared little enough about the opinion of the minor minister, but he despised any shame the Order of the Silent Shadow might incur due to those failures.
If Satellite could leverage General Garvin to actually capture these Spartan abominations, he would more than make amends for the loss of so many warriors and vessels on Saopa. Of course, any perceived alliance on Garvin's part would be utterly false. The planet would be cleansed soon enough, as the others before it. These Spartans, however, could not be allowed to continue, even if it required stringing along a disorganized clan of human rebels for a time. In Zatulai's estimation, the Spartans were the only real threat humanity had displayed so far, and he would use every tool at his disposal to eradicate them before they became a danger to the Hierarch's plans. Zatulai extended a hand and turned it palm up. Garvin stared at the hand in perplexity for a moment, then finally seemed to take it as a gesture of acceptance. If that's a yes, I'm going to need a way to contact you. Zatulai pointed to the small woman called Petora and motioned for her to follow him. She seemed someone intelligent enough to understand the principles of operating a supraluminal communicator, and the consequences of allowing it to fall into Spartan hands.
Chapter 19 0546 Hours, March 26th, 2526, Military Calendar. UNSC Point Blank Class Stealth Cruiser Vanishing Point. Assault Approach, Planet Etalon, Igris System. An invasion fleet needed five things to press its advance. Munitions, medicine, food, fuel, and spare parts. Fuel was rarely a problem because most vessels carried enough aboard to power their fusion reactors for years at a time. But eliminate any of the other four necessities, and sooner or later, a fleet was just so much scrap metal. During the slipspace journey from Biko to Etalon, John 117 and Avery Johnson had decided to attack the Covenant munitions supply first, and its food supply second, since those were the two quickest ways to bring the alien offensive to a standstill. The trouble was, after observing the enemy logistics fleet for several days, it was still hard to tell the munitions carriers from the hospital ships or equipment freighters. The Vanishing Point's intelligence analysts were fairly certain that the vessels with transparent domes were agricultural ships. But there were three low-orbiting behemoths that remained a complete mystery to everyone. The trio kept skimming the atmosphere and sinking into orbital decay, then having to activate their engines and boost themselves out of trouble. And time seemed to have run out. The alien logistics fleet was sinking orbits and bringing their fusion reactors to full power, probably because the Covenant assault fleet had secured the battlefield and was ready for replenishment. There was no way to confirm that supposition. The Vanishing Point and its two prowler escort had been out of touch since slipping away from Task Force Yama 6 days earlier. But only a fool would think that Colonel Crowther and his Black Daggers could have tipped the battle in favor of the Biko Guard's tiny armada and stopped the aliens from glassing the planet. "This can still work," Johnson said. He was standing with Blue Team in the Vanishing Point's aft fighter hangar, watching a trio of green friend dots lead a swarm of red foe triangles across the display screen hanging high on the bulkhead. "Let's take out the agricultural ships." "What we think are the agricultural ships," Fred said. Like John and the rest of Blue Team, he was standing in full Mjolnir, holding an armed Mark 2521 Havoc in the crook of one arm. "They could be petting zoos for all we know." "Yeah, but at least we'd be eliminating all their petting zoos," Johnson said. He wore black space assault armor and had his own Havoc at his feet, next to an M99 Stanchion Gauss rifle. On his armor's mag mounts, he carried an M41 Spanker rocket launcher. Technically, the Spanker was a surface-to-surface weapon, but it could be devastating in space assaults, where its range and accuracy were not degraded by gravity and atmospheric drag. "So whatever they need petting zoos for, they'd be stuck until they could bring more forward." "I think we can do better than that, Sergeant Johnson." Dr. Halsey's voice came from the hangar hatch behind them.
She crossed in front of Task Force Yama's 5 captured Banshee fighters, then stopped in front of the team and continued in a low voice. In fact, I'm quite sure we can eliminate the munitions carriers as planned.
You've identified them? John asked.
Do you really think I'd be allowing you to sacrifice my Banshees if I hadn't? The value of those craft to my research is inestimable, and we have no idea when we'll capture more.
Halsey turned to the bulkhead display screen and spread her fingers, expanding the tactical map until it showed 15 red designators, all spread along a line on the near side of Etalon, the alien logistics fleet sinking orbits in preparation for departure. She pointed to a trio of crimson diamonds still preparing to transfer out of a low orbit. Those big air skimmers are the munitions carriers.
No offense, Avery Johnson said, but how can you be sure?
His faceplate was turning between Halsey and the tactical map, where 20 green dots were diving into Etalon's gravity well, blowing through the mass of red triangles and squares that had come up to meet them. Each green dot represented an S-14 Bazillard Space Striker assault fighter with a 2-person crew, while the red symbols represented 2 different kinds of alien fighters. Triangles for exo-atmosphere Banshee fighters, and squares for a much larger and deadlier craft nicknamed the Seraph. Fortunately, there were a lot of Banshee triangles and only a few Seraph squares in the swarm, and John was hopeful that the Bazillard squadron would be able to penetrate the enemy fighter screen. The 4 Bazillards in the center of the formation were crewed by havoc-carrying Spartans. If they could get near enough to the 4 logistics vessels identified on the tactical map by the red octagons, all 8 of those Spartans would go EV and use the empty fighters as decoys while they sneaked their havocs aboard the target vessels by infiltrating through a hangar, an airlock, or even a plasma cannon port. It was a risky mission, but to John that seemed par for the course lately. The Spartans had been created to serve primarily as a high-impact force against enemy surface formations, so any space operation that involved them going EV was fraught with perils they were not equipped to handle. During an EVA mission, a Spartan could easily be lost to a stray plasma strike or a chance collision, and just like that, a soldier with 8 years of expensive elite training, protected by a suit of armor that cost as much as a UNSC starship, would be gone. But if one thing had become clear after fighting the Covenant for just a few short months, it was that humanity needed to fight the aliens however it could, even if that meant assuming exceptional risk for an operation with this kind of potential to rock the Covenant back on its heels. The intelligence analysts felt about 70% confident that the vessels represented by red octagons were equipment freighters carrying the spare parts and raw materials needed to keep the enemy battle fleet operational. If those ships could be destroyed, the Covenant fleet would be forced to avoid fighting until replacements were brought forward, a process that would delay their invasion timetable by at least a month. And in this war, a month's respite might well mean the difference between humanity's survival and its destruction. But Spartans were too valuable and rare to risk lightly. Kurt 051 and Joshua 029, who were leading green and gold teams in the attack, had firm instructions to abort their mission if it appeared the Spartans' Bazillards would not reach their targets. And, of course, there was a flexible but robust retrieval plan with 5 different contingencies for recovering each Spartan whether or not the attacks succeeded, or were even attempted. Despite this, John knew his fellow Spartans well enough to know that the last thing on their mind were mission-aborting contingencies. They would do whatever it took to complete the objective. After a moment, Halsey seemed to decide it would be easier to answer Johnson than argue with him. "I'm sure because I understand how the Covenant's plasma weapons function," she said. "Do I really need to explain the engineering to you, Sergeant? How about the short version?" There was a suspicious undertone in Johnson's voice, as though Nyato's was not the only command he viewed as being infiltrated by insurrectionist spies. "It's not like I'm trying to build one myself."
"Good, because humans don't have the magnetic stabilization technology," Halsey said. "But the theory is simple enough. A quantity of liquefied carrier gas is passed through an electric arc, where it's stripped of electrons and transformed into a thermal plasma. Then it's confined inside a magnetic capsule and launched at a target. So the air skimmers collect the gas, Kelly asked. And cool and compress it into a liquefied form, yes, Halsey said. That's why they've been dipping into Edelon's atmosphere. John frowned inside his helmet. There was no way Dr. Halsey was a spy. But her story didn't add up. And it took you 4 days to figure that out? Halsey flashed him a tight smile. Hartley, she said, I figured it out about 5 minutes after we arrived. And you waited until now to tell us? Johnson said, raising his voice. Are you crazy? We could have planned— No plan is adequate if the enemy knows your intentions, Halsey interrupted. And it's impossible to be certain what kind of comm technology the insurrectionist spies we're currently hosting have at their fingertips. Are you telling us that there are still spies aboard the Vanishing Point? Linda asked. Like Avery Johnson, she had a spanker on her mag mount and an M99 stanchion Gauss rifle resting on the deck at her feet. Then why are they still alive? I don't know who they are, Halsey said, or even if they're aboard. All I know for certain is that this ship has more bugs than the kitchen in my first apartment. And you haven't had them removed, John asked. No, and I'm not going to, Halsey said. They're vital to my operational strategy. What strategy? Johnson asked. He turned to John and spoke over TeamCom. Did she tell you about any operational strategies? Halsey turned and tapped the bud in her ear. I can hear you, Sergeant Johnson. Still a fair question, Johnson said. And how long have you known that Lieutenant Commander Naedo has spies in his command? I've known that Naedo is a spy since the after-action briefing on Saoba, when he exposed John's age, Halsey said. There's only one way he could have developed that information, so I swept my office and lab for eavesdropping devices. And you found some? John asked. Oh, many, Halsey said. Some quite sophisticated. I almost missed the data miner in my lab systems. That makes me feel better. Fred raised his arm and twisted the armor-encased limb back and forth. Any chance our Mjolnir systems are compromised? None. How do you know? John asked. Halsey appeared puzzled by the question. Because you're still alive, John. Hector Naedo has been trying to destroy the Spartan II program since the moment he learned of it. I should have seen what he was doing sooner. We should have seen it, too. Kelly tipped her helmet toward the others, suggesting that the entire team should have been more suspicious of the man, then said, Are you sure our systems are clean? The last thing we need is a rogue subroutine putting our armor into lockdown in the middle of a battle. I'm sure, Halsey said. Naedo isn't the only one who knows how to use surveillance devices. The maintenance module hasn't been breached. So let's say 90% confidence, John said over TeamCom. Have your onboard computers run a diagnostics check on your suit systems. Then run one on the computer itself. If anything looks funny, I can hear you, Halsey reminded him. And I wouldn't let you go out if there was any chance your systems had been compromised. Yes, you would, Johnson said. The Spartans may be your creations, Dr. Halsey, but they're soldiers. You're not doing anyone a favor by trying to sugarcoat that. Halsey thought for a moment, then nodded. She turned to John and said, We'd better put that confidence rating at 80% then. One of Naedo's people could have been in the maintenance module before I realized there was a problem. Fair enough, Johnson said. Now about your operational strategy. What about it? Johnson merely cocked his helmet to the side, a gesture of frustration that he had picked up from the Spartans. Halsey sighed. I suppose you're right. She glanced up at the bulkhead display, where the tactical map showed the various chases between the alien fighters and the Vanishing Point's Bazillard strikers continuing unabated. The Bazillard squadron diving down Edelon's gravity well was shooting through the enemy fighter swarms, and well on its way toward the logistics fleet's orbit, and John knew it wouldn't be long before the two Spartan teams in the center of the formation had to fake the destruction of their craft and go extra vehicular. Rather than missiles, the Spartans' basilards were carrying pods full of chain-linked debris that would help camouflage their Mjolnir armor from pursuers, and, with a little luck, cause a few high-velocity collisions. A separate trio of basilard decoys was closing on the vanishing point from a slightly lower orbit, with another swarm of enemy fighters on their tails. These basilards were part of a second mission that would target the munitions carriers. The plan called for Blue Team to infiltrate the munitions ships by flying a captured Banshee straight into one of their hangars. Once inside, the Spartans and Johnson would crash their Banshees in an area where it would be difficult to jettison the fighters, then activate the 30-second timers on their Havocs, leave them inside the cockpits, and extract by going EV for a Prowler pickup. As a precaution against losing all 12 of Task Force Yama's Spartans in the same attack, Blue Team's mission would only be a go if it appeared that Green and Gold Team's mission was proceeding as planned. So far, that seemed to be the case, and the three decoys would be leading their pursuers past the vanishing point's bow in 9 minutes. Given that it would take Johnson and Blue Team 5 minutes to fire up their captured Banshees, and another 2 minutes to depressurize the hangar, there wasn't a lot of time left for Dr. Halsey to explain the subtleties of one of her intricate strategies. "You'll need to trust me on the details of my strategy for now," she said. "But one of the devices we captured from the downed vessel on Sayoba was a holographic slipspace chart." John almost gasped. "And you can read it?" "A little better every day," Dr. Halsey said. "In fact, I believe I'm well on the way to discovering the Covenant's primary supply depot for this area of space." "Well on the way, huh?" Johnson asked. "What's that mean exactly?" "That I've identified several possibilities," Halsey said. "If we succeed here and force the invasion fleet to resupply, I'll be able to narrow that number down to 1. "And then we can slip in and nuke it," John said. The implications were huge. Even an unsuccessful attack on the Covenant supply depot would force the aliens to divert resources to defending it. And actually destroying it? That would not only shake their confidence, but it would erode their ability to carry on offensive operations in this part of human-occupied space. "I like it." "I thought you might." Halsey pointed at the trio of air skimmers. "But first, you have to eliminate those. It's the only way to force the Covenant's hand." Chapter 20. 0559 hours, March 26th, 2526. Military calendar. UNSC Point Blank Class Stealth Cruiser Vanishing Point. Assault Approach. Planet Etalon. Igdris System. Not one of the captured Banshee fighters looked combat-worthy. Their hulls had been carefully riddled with cannon holes, their canards and tail stabilizers had been shot half off, and their identifying symbols had been obscured by soot or gouging. Impact stars and stress cracks had been painted across the integrated antennas in the canopies, a precaution to explain their comm silence to any Covenant pilots visually checking on the craft. John was pretty sure that if Dr. Halsey had known the Banshee equivalent of a flat tire, she would have added that too, as a way to cover for any deficiencies in Blue Team's piloting skills. Fortunately, the Spartans had spent most of their spare time in Dr. Halsey's projects hangar, learning how to operate all manner of captured Covenant equipment, and they were decent pilots. Even more fortunately, all of the Banshees were in at least fair working order and capable of holding their own in a dogfight, and John had every reason to believe they would hold together long enough to get him and the rest of Blue Team into the middle of the alien logistics fleet. Once the hangar hatch had snicked closed behind Dr. Halsey, John made a twirling motion with his finger, signaling the team to take their Havocs and load up. He stepped into the middle Banshee, lying prone on the pilot's cushion and securing his own Havoc to a temporary mag mount on the back of his Mjolnir armor. John pulled the opaque canopy down and sealed the cockpit, then brought the fighter's impulse drive online and activated the instrument console. He couldn't read any of the symbols that appeared in the holographic readout panels, but after a few lessons from Dr. Halsey, he and the 4 other Banshee pilots, the other members of Blue Team and Avery Johnson, had learned through trial and error what panels they needed to watch closely. Once the drive's panel had assumed a warm amber glow and the symbols remained more or less steady, he pulled the stability harness up over his flanks and hips, then placed his hands on the control grips to either side of the viewscreen. A blue luminescence arose inside the spheres, and more symbols began to swirl through the holographic readout panels. He slid his palms toward the front of the control grips. The Banshee rose off the deck and hovered in place. Through the wide-angle viewscreen, John could see that the four other Banshees were also floating about a meter off the deck. In front of them, a remotely piloted S-14 Bazillard was powered up and trembling on its struts, its single-thrust nozzle glowing pale orange with thermal buildup. The throaty voice of the Bazillard's remote pilot, who would be controlling the S-14 from an observation bubble high in the vanishing point stern, came over the internal comm channel. "Hangar depressurized," she said. "Blue team ready?" A row of LEDs, including one for Avery Johnson, winked green inside John's helmet. "Affirmative," John said. "Blue team ready." The hangar lights darkened. Then the exterior doors retracted to reveal the pallid face of the planet Etelan. The entire world was suffocating in its own ash, with slate-gray bands of ground showing between pearl-colored ribbons of airborne smoke. In a clear swath, John could see 100 giant, charcoal-colored plumes billowing up from an orange lake of lava as wide across as his palm. 10 seconds, the remote pilot announced. John could not quite understand what he was seeing on the planet below. From what he had been told about the Covenant's method of orbital bombardment, the aliens could glass no more than a few square kilometers of ground at a time, leveling man-made structures and incinerating plant life with plasma beams so hot they melted the silica in the ground itself. But what he saw on Etelan was on a whole new level. It was as though the Covenant had punched through the planet's crust into its mantle, creating a volcanic geyser that was going to burn away the last traces of humanity by flooding the entire world with molten stone. And if the aliens had that kind of power, if they were capable of cruelty on such a massive scale, Task Force Yama had to slow their invasion, whatever the cost. 5 seconds, the remote pilot announced. You should be able to see the decoy flight crossing from right to left, and on course to pass above the eruption. She had barely finished speaking before slivers of plasma began to lance past the launching portal, followed an instant later by the wedge-shaped silhouettes of three S-14 Bazillards. A breath later, the cruciform shadows of an alien Banshee squadron appeared on their tails, closing slowly, but filling the intervening distance with white fire. The vanishing point cold-launched a salvo of 20 pre-targeted M-42 Archer missiles, using compressed air to push them out of their firing tubes with engines quiet. In the hangar, the remotely piloted Bazillard retracted its struts and shot out of the launching portal. It was accelerating so hard that in a heartbeat, its thrust nozzle shrank from a 2-meter circle of blinding brilliance into a white dot the size of a thumbnail. It attacked the Banshee squadron at once, firing both of its M-42 Archer missiles and opening up at extreme range with its twin rotary cannons. An eye blink later, the Vanishing Point's Archer salvo ignited engines and flew after the Banshees as well. The astonished aliens broke formation and scattered, leaving the three Bazillards free to roll out and escape. "Blue team, launch," John ordered. He pushed the control grips forward, and the captured Banshee blasted from the hangar at such speed that only the stability harness kept him from sliding toward the back of the cockpit. Johnson and the rest of Blue Team followed in the remaining Banshees, and they all fell in behind the remotely piloted Bazillard. Behind them, John knew, the vanishing point would be vacating its waste holds, dumping depleted fuel pellets, empty shell casings, irreparable equipment, damaged parts, and any other kind of metallic refuse that a long-range sensor probe might interpret as shards of destroyed space fighters. John began to tap the undersides of the control grips, pouring plasma bolts into the tail of the remotely piloted Bazillard. His companions did likewise, and the space fighter quickly self-destructed in a giant fireball designed to draw the aliens' attention and help the vanishing point withdraw undetected. Elite voices began to sound inside the cockpit, no doubt other Banshee pilots asking for identification from Blue Team. John ignored them and led his flight straight toward the reassembling squadron. Since they had no way of convincingly communicating with the aliens, the team's best chance of slipping into the enemy formation was to ignore any attempt to contact them and hope the Covenant would assume their comm equipment had been damaged. And if that didn't work, the Vanishing Point and her two escort prowlers were staying close, in case Blue Team needed a distraction. When no one in Blue Team responded to the hails, a trio of enemy Banshees broke away from the squadron and came out to intercept the new arrivals. John kept his fingers away from the weapon controls. He had no idea what the alien protocol might be for such situations, and he didn't want to find himself automatically responding to a challenge rush or signal burst. He wished he had thought to suggest the same thing to the others, but it was too late now. To prevent the possibility of the Covenant noticing strange transmissions coming from the damaged Banshees, Blue Team would be maintaining complete comm silence until it grew apparent that the enemy wasn't buying their act. The intercepting Banshees swelled quickly from tiny specks silhouetted against thumb-sized thrust halos into drooping crosses being pushed along on 30-meter efflux tails, then dropped their noses and flashed past beneath Blue Team. On his own craft's tracking panel, John saw the enemy fighters swing up behind his flight and match velocities. Two of them hung back, ready to open fire on the formation from behind, while the third crept slowly forward, passing within 20 meters of each damaged Banshee, no doubt so the pilot could inspect them. Finally, it reached the front of the formation and hung alongside John at about the same distance. The enemy pilot remained alongside for nearly a minute, when elite chatter started to sound over John's comm system. It began to seem likely that the alien had been awaiting some signal and was requesting instructions from his commander. John tried the standard wing waggle, but that drew no response. He slid his hands toward the back of the controls. The Banshee responded by dropping its tail and lifting its nose, and John quickly returned his hands to the original position. More comm chatter filled the cockpit, and the alien inspector finally moved ahead of the flight. He rocked his own craft in a manner similar to what John had done, then led the entire flight back into the main squadron. Once all the Banshees were together, the unit commander quickly aligned them above the logistics fleet and began to sync orbits. Because of the squadron's much higher orbit, the process would involve a lengthy series of thruster burns, timed to drop it into position either just ahead of or behind the logistics fleet. John relaxed a bit. They had planned this attack to the last detail that could be foreseen, and that was what made it possible to handle the little things they had no way of predicting. Below him, he could see the tiny wedges of 12 Basilards juking and jinking as they tried to drop into orbit ahead of the logistics fleet. He suspected that the 8 missing craft had been destroyed as they passed through the fighter screen, but the fact that the squadron had not aborted its run suggested that the Basilards carrying green and gold teams were still intact, which was a good thing. With so many enemy Banshees in formation behind them, Blue Team had just passed its own mission's no-abort point. Planning. It was as much of an asset to the Spartans as their Mjolnir armor. A pair of Basilards burst into orange flashes and vanished. John watched for hints that it had been one of his Spartan teams going EV, but saw no signs either way. No tiny specks silhouetted against the pearly clouds below. No Covenant fighters circling back to attack unseen targets. No flickers of small arms fire. Either the attack was working as planned, or the Vanishing Point had just lost 2 more fighter crews. The thought made John queasy, and he found himself feeling a bit guilty about all of the lives being sacrificed to deliver his Spartans to their targets safely. At least the cause was worthy. Assuming Dr. Halsey was right about finding the Covenant supply depot, succeeding today would not only slow the enemy invasion, it would give Task Force Yama the opportunity to serve the Covenant a pushback they would never forget. Another pair of Basilards exploded, and John now felt confident that both green and gold teams had gone EV to attack their targets. When their Havocs detonated, Blue Team would take advantage of the inevitable confusion to slip away from their escorts and head for the 3 air skimmers. After that, It would be a simple matter of flying into the closest hangar and crashing their Banshees, then setting a timer switch and shooting their way out before their own Havocs detonated. The Banshee squadron escorting Blue Team dropped into orbit 10 kilometers behind a huge, pear-shaped materials freighter, and John started to worry about timing. If the green and gold team bombs didn't detonate before... John's view screen flashed silver as the freighter suddenly vanished in the white wink of a nuclear detonation. His comms